Trok reasoned that the priests at the main temple of Ninurta within the city walls must regularly correspond with those in the river temple. Almost certainly, they used this aqueduct as a thoroughfare between the two communities. It would not take long for them to discover that something untoward had happened to their brethren in the river temple. He had to make his plans swiftly. Trok chose 200 of his best and most reliable men, all members of his own leopard tribe. He divided them into two groups. Once they'd fought their way through the aqueduct into the city, the first group was to secure the blue gate and keep it open until Pharaoh Naja Kiafan could lead the main force through it. The second, much smaller group, were to make their way into the palace and seize Sargon's treasury before he was able to dispose of the gold.
"Although it would take 1,000 wagons to carry it all away,"
Ishtar assured him. The chosen 200 were dressed in the uniforms of Sargon's army, taken from the prisoners and the dead men left on the battlefield. They wore the long, ankle-length tunics of striped material, belted at the waist, and the tall, beehive-shaped helmets. Ishtar showed them how to cut their beards and hair into the characteristic ringlets of the Mesopotamians. They wore only a red sash to distinguish them from the foe. Rough copies of the city map were hastily drawn by the army scribes and issued to the captains of both divisions so that they knew the layout of the streets and buildings. By evening, every man knew exactly what was expected of him once he entered the city. As soon as it was dark, Naja quietly moved his assault force up into position outside the Blue Gate, ready to dash through into the city as soon as Trok's men threw it open. In the courtyard of the river temple of Ninurta, Trok mustered his division. While it was still daylight, he and Ishtar led them in single file down the spiral staircase to the level of the aqueduct. There was no hurry, for they had many hours in which to make the long subterranean journey. Their cleated sandals had been muffled with leather socks, so their heavy footsteps did not echo along the gloomy tunnel. They marched in silence, every tenth man carrying a torch, giving just sufficient light for the men who followed to make out their footing on the slimy stones of the pier. At their left hand, the never-ending flow of water rustled darkly by. Every 1,000 paces, Ishtar stopped to placate the god Ninurta with gifts and incantations, and to clear the way ahead of the magical obstacles and barriers placed by the dead priests. Nevertheless, the silent march seemed endless to Trok, and it came as a surprise when abruptly Ishtar stopped and pointed ahead. The faint glimmer of light was reflected off the shiny ceramic walls. Trok signalled the men following him to halt, then went forward with Ishtar. Over their own garments they wore headdresses and purple robes taken from the bodies of the slaughtered priests. As they went towards the source of the light, they saw another grill gate across the tunnel, and the distorted shadows of men thrown on the walls by the light of a torch set in a bracket above the gate. As they drew closer, they saw that on the other side of the grill two robed priests were seated on stools, with the Bayo board between them, absorbed in their game. They looked up when Ishtar called softly to them. The fat one stood up and wobbled to the gate.
"Are you from Sinnar?" he called.
"Yes," Ishtar assured him.
"You're late. We've been waiting since nightfall. You should have been here hours ago. The High Priest will be displeased."
"I am sorry," Ishtar sounded contrite. "But you know, Sinnar."
The fat priest chuckled.
"I know, Sinnar. He taught me my responses 30 years ago."
His key jangled in the lock of the gate, and then he swung it open.
"You must hurry," he said.
Trok trotted forward with the hood over his face, holding his sword in the fold of his robe. The priest stood back against the wall to let him pass. Trok stopped in front of him and whispered,
"Ninurta will reward you, brother,"
and killed him with a thrust up under his chin into his brain. With a shout of alarm, his companion leapt to his feet, knocking over the Bayo board and scattering the stones across the pier.
With two long strides, Trock reached him and chopped his head half off. Without another sound, the priest fell backwards into the dark stream, and with his robes ballooning about him, buoying him up, he was carried away down the tunnel. Trock gave a soft whistle, and with the muted tramp as muffled feet, his men moved up into the torchlight with drawn swords. Ishtar led them forward until they reached the foot of another steep stone stairway. They went up it quickly until they came to a heavy curtain blocking their way. Ishtar peeped round its edge and nodded. "The temple is empty." Trock stepped through and looked about him. This temple was even larger and more impressive than the river temple. The ceiling was so high that the light from 50 torches was eaten up by the shadows. Below them, the image of the god crouched over the mouth of the shaft, from which the full force of the aqueduct spurted like a gigantic fountain into a deep pond with a white marble coping. The corpse of the priest that Trock had almost decapitated was floating in the pool, from which the water spilled over into the canal that carried it to the city. Although the smell of incense was thick in the air, the great hall of the temple was deserted. Trock signalled his men to come forward. As soon as they emerged from the tunnel, they formed up behind their captains in silence. Trock gave the hand signal, and they went forward at a trot. Ishtar led the smaller band through a side door of the hall into a corridor that connected with the palace of Sargon. Trock led his men out into the narrow lane behind the temple, and, working only from his memory of the map, turned at the second lane into the wide avenue that he knew led to the Blue Gate. It was still dark, and the stars blazed above the sleeping city. They met a number of cloaked figures on their way, one or two staggering drunk, but the others scurried out of their way and let the dark column of armed warriors pass. A woman with a child in her arms called after them, "May Marduk smile upon you, brave warriors, and keep us safe from Trock, the barbarian of Egypt." Trock understood just enough Akkadian to catch her meaning, and smiled into his beard. Disguised in their plundered robes, they reached the end of the avenue without being challenged further. But as the gateway loomed ahead, a voice sang out at them from the door of the guardhouse, "Stand ho! Give the watchword for tonight!" A centurion of the gate, with 5 men at his back, stepped out into the torchlight. But they were ill-prepared, without helmets and body armour, their eyes puffy and their faces still crumpled with sleep. "The honourable emissary of King Sargon to the pharaohs of Egypt," Trock mumbled in execrable Akkadian, and gave the hand signal for his troops to charge. "Open the gate and stand aside!" He ran straight at the centurion. For a moment longer the man stood uncertainly. Then he saw the glint of swords and shouted urgently, "Stand to arms! Turn out the guard!" But it was too late. Trock was on him and dropped him in his tracks with a single blow. His men swarmed over the other guards before they could defend themselves. But the noise had alerted the sentinels on the parapets above the gate. They sounded the alarm with braying ram's horns and hurled their javelins down into the attackers. "Winkle them out of there!" Trock ordered, and half his men rushed up the ramps on either side of the gateway to reach the parapet. They were at once locked in close and desperate fighting with the guards on the wall. Trock kept half his men with him. Ishtar had described the gate room that housed the complicated machinery, a system of heavy winches and pulleys that operated the massive gates. Trock led his men to the entrance before the defenders within could close the doors, and after only a few minutes of furious fighting, they had killed and wounded most of them. The survivors threw down their weapons. Some fell to their knees and pleaded, in vain, for quarter. They were stabbed and clubbed as they knelt. The others fled out of the postern gate, and Trock led his men to the massive winches. With 2 men on each spoke of the capstans, they began to open the gates. But the ram's horns had aroused the city guards, who swarmed out of their barracks, some without armour and still half asleep, and rushed to defend the gateway. Trock barred the heavy door to the winch room and placed men at the entrance to defend it. On the parapets above the gateway, his men had killed the defenders or thrown them from the top of the wall,
and now they fought on the ramps, holding off the attacking Babylonians. The door to the winch room trembled and bulged as the Babylonians battered at it, trying desperately to break in. But the winches revolved slowly to the efforts of Trock's men, and the mighty gates rose from their seatings, the gap under them widening inexorably. The avenue leading to the gates was by now crowded with Babylonian defenders, but they were hampered by their own numbers. Only four abreast could mount the ramps to the top of the walls, and Trock's men met them and hurled them back. Others were still trying to break into the room that housed the winches, but the doors were sturdy. When at last they smashed them down, they found Trock and his men waiting for them on the threshold. Outside the walls, Narja's men had swarmed forward with crowbars and levers. They forced the heavy gates wider and wider, until at last a squadron of chariots could pass through. Then they stood aside, and Narja led a phalanx of fighting chariots in a brutal charge through the gateway and swept the avenue from side to side. The army of Egypt poured through behind them. Trock took command of them and led them rampaging through the city towards the palace. The sack of Babylon had begun.